In 2024, San Antonio firefighters negotiated a new 3-year contract, and owners of dangerous dogs that get loose are facing higher fines and tougher punishments. Voters approved new charter amendments, resulting in city council terms getting longer and city council salaries getting bigger. 18 people have jumped into the May 2025 mayor's race, and one candidate has already dropped out. The San Antonio Missions will be building a new stadium downtown, and now all eyes are on Project Marvel, an idea to revitalize downtown with a new land bridge, a new Spurs arena, and a new sports and entertainment district. These stories and more are the topic for this episode. Joining me are two veterans of City Hall politics. Rob Killen of Killen, Griffin, and Fairmont, a founding member of the San Antonio-based law firm focused on land use and economic development. And Aaron Bly of Onyx Political Affairs, a veteran lobbyist and strategist who represents clients before the San Antonio City Council. From the podcast studio at Lano Realty Partners, we now take a look back at 2024 with Rob Killen and Aaron Bly. Clearly, we've had a lot of things happen in San Antonio, both at the local governmental level, but also elsewhere in other things like the airport and things like that. Looking back at 2024, I want to start with the charter amendments, because I think those were big. And Aaron, I'll start with you. What, if anything, surprised you with that election?
Well, it was really hard to gauge how the campaign side was going. And, you know, seeing what advertisements and marketing, and we didn't really see a whole lot going on. So we were a little nervous going into it. Rob and I talked a lot about it. So we were happily surprised by how much they all passed, to be honest.
I would agree. Rob, do you?
I agree. I'm surprised that they passed. I'm surprised that they passed by the margins they passed. And I'm surprised that voters supported things like ethics, removing archaic language, the change to allow employees to participate in campaigns. But to me, the most surprising thing was the fact that there weren't any big surprises. What voters seem to do on November 5th is express that they're happy with their government. Why would you give city council members 2 4-year terms? Why would you allow them to make more money, increase their pay? And why would you give them full discretion over hiring and firing the city manager for whatever term? So to me, it was surprising that voters were so supportive of their city council.
I was surprised by the margin of victory on some of those. I was also surprised by, I don't remember if it was A or B, but you couldn't even understand it because it was a bunch of letters and edit this and remove this word and add this word
that
in.
That was the language update, I think.
Yes.
And that passed by 68%. So.
But I think, you know, despite a lot of the criticism that the mayor and the council may get from a wide variety of circles, whether it's Austin or whether it's people here in town, it did seem to send a message that people were happy. However, having said that, we can get into some of the individual things that stir controversy. So let's talk about the term limits. Going from 2 years to 4 years, was that a surprise?
That it passed?
Yes.
I think so. I mean, personally, I was in favor of that. I don't know how Rob feels, but because it's less campaigning and we're, you know, we have the person in office for 4 years. So instead of having to campaign a year in, they now have kind of a 4-year runway to do more work. So I think personally, it's a good thing. And I was surprised that it passed the way that it did.
I had mixed feelings on that one. And the reason I had mixed feelings is because of like Mario Bravo.
Right.
He served one term and then his district, his constituents decided they wanted somebody else because of some of the missteps that he had. And the bar for a recall is usually a little higher. But Rob, what's your take on that one?
I strongly supported the 4-year term. I thought it was a great idea. I think it's important for consistency. I think it takes longer than 2 years to figure out how to do the job of being a council member. So to the extent that they've got a little bit more time to figure out how to do what they're doing, how to see policies through, maybe not to the end, but certainly substantially to the end, I think it's a good thing. And I think from a business community standpoint, it gives us a longer period of time to build relationships with folks who are on council between having to face the voters. So I think that they can make unpopular decisions earlier in their term now without having to worry about what they're doing. They can think, I think, on a more global scale than they have been.
But that being said, you know, we're going to have five new people at City Hall. So four new council people and a new mayor, and we're going to have them for 4 years. And that could be a long 4 years, depending on who gets elected.
This can be an issue because you're not only having half of the council turning over, but they're there for a very extended term. In many cases, historically, city managers like to wait out until a problematic council member, you know, went off the council. But now you have, to your point, you have a much longer runway. Rob?
You're absolutely right. So does it change the balance of power between city staff and particularly city manager and council? Clearly. And I think in some cases that is for the good. If we're electing good people to office, that kind of oversight is critically important. We have a great city manager now in Eric Walsh. We've got great assistant city managers, deputy city managers, and department directors. But that's not always been the case and will not always be the case. So if our council members who we get to elect and directly interact with have more oversight over staff, I think that's really a good thing.
There is one consequence to this new four-year term, and that's to John Courage. And we're going to get into the mayor's race later, but I think, would you agree that that was a determining factor in his decision to pull out of the race?
I think that was the factor. I think when he originally decided he was going to run for mayor, he assumed it would only be for 2 years, and weighing kind of, you know, his career path and goals, and that this would be the end, you know, kind of the end of his council, and then to get to be mayor for 2 years would be great. And I think once he realized it was 4 years, and then there was other factors as well, from what we've heard, you know, personal issues and health issues, and his wife recently retired from CPS Energy. So I think once he realized he would not be 76 leaving office, he'd be 78 leaving office, that really changed his tune.
And that was John's comment, is he'd be 78 when he left office. And I think this might impact other folks who are considering running for office, who might be willing to try it for 2 years, but can't make a 4-year commitment or potentially up to an 8-year commitment. So we saw a number of council members who still had terms ahead of them when we were under 4 2-year terms, who decided not to run for reelection, like Joe Cryer and Mike Gallagher. And so this might dissuade folks from serving longer.
Could this also dissuade somebody who might have been thinking, I don't want to run for mayor against 374 people that have filed. I will wait to the end of the 2-year term, and then I will, if that mayor is not that successful, then I will run one-on-one against the mayor at that time. But now that it's a 4-year term, is this likely to dissuade any of that thinking? I'm not saying that thinking was out there, but I'm just asking.
We used to see that all the time when it was 2 2-year terms. Anyone can wait 4 years. And so you let the incumbent run for reelection, you don't challenge them and wait them out. Once we went to 4 2-year terms, I think that changed. You'd see people challenge incumbents. So we started to see that change in the pattern when we went to the – so it was a total of 8 years, and still a total of 8 years. So that hasn't really changed. But I think the willingness to challenge an incumbent is probably going to be about the same as it has been with the 4 2-year terms.
I want to talk about the firefighter contract because I think that was clearly a big issue this year in 2024. It started off with Councilwoman Marina Alderete Gavito getting a pass from the city attorney, Andy Segovia, that she did not have a conflict because her brother's a firefighter and he's one of X number of firefighters. So it was not something that was going to, her voting on it and being in council discussion and executive sessions was not a conflict of interest. But clearly she got scolded by the newspaper, but it seemed to go a little bit quicker than what we've seen in the past, and no issues on her part. Erin, what's your take on how that transpired?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because, you know, the firefighters union started going out and having their own one-on-one meetings with business leaders. So they went around and were briefing everyone after they'd already talked to council, telling the business community that they had council support. So I hadn't seen that happen before in the previous negotiations. So I thought it was an interesting tactic because they're showing, hey, we have the council votes. We've got to get this across the finish line. And hearing their side of the story versus what you read in the headlines and from city staff, it kind of made it a little more clear, you know, that we had to get this resolved. So I think for city staff's perspective, they handled it as best that they could. You know, it didn't, I think it didn't drag on quite as long as the last time. But then again, what, it's up in 2 more years for renegotiation anyway. So I think overall the firefighters felt generally happy when it was done, that they got what they, you know, most of what they wanted from what I'd heard from them.
Rob, your take.
Oh, first of all, we're talking about people whose job is to run into burning buildings and put their lives in jeopardy every day. I'm glad that they're going to be well paid, that they're going to get great benefits. I'm glad that we as a city have found a way to continue to recruit great firefighters. In terms of Marina's point, I don't see a conflict there. I'm San Antonio, like any town, has people who are involved and they run for public office, so they serve on various boards and commissions. And, you know, we all have tight-knit families. And so you can't disqualify someone just because, in this case, her brother happens to be a firefighter. But I think the way the firefighters approached it this time was different, whether that was an influencing factor. But as Aaron mentioned, going out to the business community and trying to solicit business community support. So it was interesting in the way that they approached it, and we'll see what they do when the contract is up again.
So two things. Number one, her brother Joe was not city manager, where he was one individual that was getting a pay raise. He was one of several hundred firefighters that would be receiving a raise. And I think she did the smart thing and the wise thing by, before this debate even started, going to the city attorney. He gave it his blessing. And I think the Express News editorial board got that one wrong. Shortly after they negotiated the contract, the firefighters came out and opposed Proposition C, but it wasn't a pedal to the metal type of opposition. It seemed limited. At some polling stations, I saw a cardboard cutout of a firefighter holding a sign saying vote against Prop C.
By the time they came out against it, it was, you know, a month before the election day. We were surprised because, again, when they were meeting with the business community, they were saying they were not going to oppose any of the propositions if they got their contract done. So they did go back on what we had heard. They were, you know, committing that they weren't going to oppose it. So I think they didn't get enough traction to really make an impact. I mean, Prop C passed with what, 54%. So maybe it affected it a couple percentage points, but at the end of the day, it still passed.
So, Rob, during the course of the negotiations, there were five council members that got upset. They went public, had a press conference. Councilwoman Melissa Cabello-Havarda went so far as to say that the city attorney should be fired.
I understand the council members who were in that group that stood on the steps of City Hall understand their frustration. They were not getting the information. The way they approached it, though, was completely unprecedented. As an attorney, I'd hate for my client to go out on public and say, we should fire this guy. So it was a different way to approach it. Again, like you said, they had ultimately, this was all, they got the information they needed, but this was not the way we have traditionally handled things at City Hall. So I think at the end of the day, it's a one-off. I don't think something like this happens again. But my biggest concern with that was that it tended to, in my mind, appear to undermine Eric Walsh's authority.
I have seen him treat different council members differently on the very same issue in the very same council meeting.
They should have gone to the city manager and had that same group meeting, but behind closed doors, and said, Eric, we have real concerns here.
And I do think some of it stemmed a little bit from just being frustrated with the mayor. You know, the mayor wasn't around a lot during that time and was off doing other things. And I think that resentment was kind of building. And so they weren't getting the information they needed from Ron and his team, even though it's really city manager. But it kind of, you know, reflected on Ron. And so I think that some of that was directed at him.
It sounds like shortly after all that occurred that the city attorney began meeting with council members one-on-one, and I've talked to several of them who seem like they aired things out and patched things up, and now it's back to business as usual. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. I think that they're doing the way they've always done. And like I said, I think that was a one-off. We're not going to see a repeat of that anytime soon.
Let's talk about the mayor's race. We mentioned briefly John Courage dropping out. And I think if you look at all the dynamics of the mayor's race, there's a lot going on. But we're looking at three of the four city council members, Adriana Rocha Garcia, Melissa Cabello-Havarda, and Manny Pelaez. John Courage dropped out. Then you have former councilman Clayton Perry. You have Beto Altamirano, the entrepreneur. You have the former Texas Secretary of State, Rolando Pablos, and now we have Gina Ortiz-Jones, who has run twice before for Congress and is a former Assistant Secretary of the Air Force. Just give me your overall thoughts on the dynamics of a mayoral race. And Rob, I'll start with you with this many candidates.
This is going to be the most consequential election we've had in living memory. Three reasons. One, this is going to be the first time in 16 years that it's been open seat for mayor. We haven't had a situation where the incumbent for mayor isn't in the race in 16 years. And so that's a big one. Two, not only do we have a new mayor, we're going to have four new council members up there. So that mayor is going to have a brand new council to work with. And then three, we already talked about this with the charter revisions. They're now running for four-year terms. So this is going to be a game changer for years to come. And it's going to be something we haven't seen in quite a long time. In fact, I would say this is a unique election in recent history. And so with the number of folks that are running for this open seat, it's going to be really hard for their messages to penetrate. And of the viable candidates, if we can use the term viable, the front runners, the only one I don't know is Gina Ortiz-Jones. But of the others, I think they all have qualities that would make them a good mayor. They each have different strengths, and they also have different challenges and weaknesses that'll hurt them both in the race and in governing. If we start with Beto, he's never had any experience in public life, but he's extremely charismatic. He understands social media. He's energized a younger population, understands technology. And so he would come to the office with that skill set, but without the experience of being in public office. Rolando Pablos, on the other end, has been Texas Secretary of State. He understands international trade. He understands governing an agency. And so he brings extensive experience coming from the outside. So it's interesting, the dynamics. And of course, you've got three current council members and a former council member in Clayton Perry, who have all been on that dais. They all know how city government runs, and they all have done a fairly good job during their terms of being pro-business and pro-development and understand what it takes to move the city forward. But they each have had a different approach to governing.
Today's episode is proudly sponsored by Llano Realty Partners. It's a San Antonio-based commercial real estate brokerage that combines the intimate local expertise of a boutique brokerage with the advanced capabilities of a modern national brokerage to provide clients with a superior level of service. With a team of experienced professionals, Llano Realty Partners is dedicated to delivering efficient results and exceeding the expectations of its clients. For more information, go to llanorealty.com. That's LLANO realty.com. Aaron, what's your take on the field of candidates?
Yeah, well, I mean, it keeps growing day by day. We're now at 18, as counting this morning, and I'm sure we're going to have more. So, you know, I think the four council people that are running, former councilmen and the three current, they come to the race with name ID. You know, whatever, however much that helps them or not, but they definitely have name ID. I'm watching Beto's campaign, and it's reminding me a lot of when Ron challenged Ivy in 2017. Ron was everywhere. He was at every event, every place. It was during Fiesta. I remember seeing him all over town, and I feel like Beto has cast a really wide net and is having all kinds of events in all parts of town. You know, it is still kind of early to be having that many events, but it could be effective. I think Rolando Pablos is a great candidate. I don't think he has, you know, much name ID at all, not having lived in San Antonio for, you know, or having jobs kind of, you know, throughout all over the country. So I think the good news is we have a good slate of candidates for mayor. Like all the names we've talked about, I think we can live with and work with and get along fine with. I do think the biggest concern is voter turnout. Look at how bad the voter turnout was on November 5th in San Antonio. I think it was about 200,000 less than they predicted. Mm-hmm. So how many – normally we have, what, 12% vote in a May election, 12 to 13?
Yes. And if there were something on the ballot like a Spurs Arena or Project Marvel or of something like that, that could drive traffic up.
But it's also during Fiesta.
Early voting overlaps with Fiesta. Correct. And Election Day is the same day as Fiesta Flambeau, the Pooch Parade.
Yes.
And the King William Fair.
Unheard of. Like no one wants to think about anything civic engagement other than how you're going to your last Fiesta event.
I've had clients or friends or colleagues who have said, hey, I'm coming to San Antonio. Can you help me set up meetings? And I said, sure. When are you coming? And they mentioned Fiesta Week. And I said, no one will meet with you.
It's like our
spring break, our Mardi Gras.
Right. So I think because of that and all those factors we talked about, I think the two candidates that get in the runoff can get in the runoff with a lot less votes because we just don't know how many people are actually going to vote.
That is a huge factor in this race. Back to your comment about Rolando, he lived in Austin. The state constitution requires you to reside in Austin when you're Secretary of State. He and Bethel both come from the border. Rolando comes from El Paso. Bethel comes from the Rio Grande Valley. The council members, I think, each come with unique skill sets. And Adriana is one of the most prepared. She does her homework. And Melissa gets very emphatic about some issues and takes tough stands. And then Councilman Pelaez, he's been around. He knows many of these issues, and he's a good communicator. The one that surprised me, I guess, was Gina. She chaired a pro-choice PAC and was focused on that here more recently. She is extremely passionate about that. I didn't think this would be something that would be attractive to her because you can't really do anything about the abortion issue at the council level. But I will say this, she is going to raise money nationally for this race. And so when you look at people have often pointed out that they think Rolando and Beto may be able to either self-fund or raise the most amount of money. I think she has that ability too, but it'll be national money, not just local money.
I agree. And I think Rolando as well will be raising from, you know, statewide and also national sources. So we'll know more once we see the next financial report, which will be what? End of this month,
it'll
early January.
Yeah, yes. December 31st.
Interesting to see what they've all raised to this point. But it's going to be very competitive.
You know, and speaking of fundraising, so that was one of the interesting things is that John Courage was the first to announce in January, but in his July fundraising report, he only showed $19,000. And so I don't know if he was just not gaining traction. It was also way early to be trying to raise money for a mayoral race.
Yeah, and I think Courage, he never really found the right support for campaign staff in his quest for mayor. And he told us that, you know, there's just not that many people available on the campaign side. So I think that also played into his decision.
I think with John, one of the reasons he didn't raise money is because he had such a great turnout in District 9. He had the most voters come out in each of his reelection campaigns. And he had built great relationships in the neighborhoods and in the community. And so he already knew that he had a base level of support without spending any money. So traditionally he hasn't spent a lot of money on his campaigns. And so knowing going into this that he had a good chance of making a runoff, all things being equal, he didn't have to raise a lot of money. But I think he would have been challenged as he started getting into fundraising because to support a mayoral campaign, he'd have to look citywide.
But if we ran the election today, though, Courage would probably win or at least be in the runoff with just his name.
All right. I want to talk about Robert Melvin. He is one of the 18 that has come in. He released a video talking about his desire to be mayor. And the issue he chose to talk about was the funding of charter schools. So I'm scratching my head a little bit, wondering why he chose that topic. Aaron, any thoughts?
I'm still scratching my head and I have no idea. You sent us the video and we watched it and really no clue. And it only said he was running for mayor once during the whole video, not even again at the end. So I really am perplexed by what the focus was for that.
You know, the city is not in the business of education, but in the last few years, we've gotten into the business of education, pre-K for SA, college preparatory support, and other things that are peripheral to education. Now, getting involved in charter schools is completely outside the city's purview, but it highlights a trend that we see in these local races, whether someone's running on pro-abortion or anti-abortion, whether pro-education or not. It gets or transportation issues, public transit kinds of things, those kinds of questions that are maybe outside the city's direct or even indirect role, but people run on those kinds of issues. And we see more and more of that each time, particularly with a large field of folks, people trying to distinguish themselves. No one's ever going to lose by being pro-education because we all like kids. But at the end of the day, the question is, does he understand the role of city government?
I think it makes perfect sense to your point when you're talking about being the convener. You know, I'm going to bring the business community together and the public education system together, even the private schools, bring them in, the community colleges, the four-year universities. And what are the stumbling blocks? What are the barriers that are preventing us from getting more people, more students through the pipeline into the workforce? That's something a mayor can easily do. You're not going to get it done by ordinance, but you can get it done with good ideas and being a leader. And I think if that's what he was attempting to do, I'm not sure it came through in that video. In a previous episode of this podcast, I had my brother James on as the Democrat political consultant and then Kelton Morgan as the Republican. They both discussed how this nonpartisan race turns out to be a very partisan campaign. And it's for a couple reasons. Number one, people want to know where you stand, even though it's a nonpartisan office. But they want to know where you stand because these issues are going to come up. And they also want to know because you might be mayor for one term, but then you might run for a partisan office after that. So they may not want to invest in you. Aaron, how do you take that those comments made by James and Kelton?
I mean, I think they're spot on. And, you know, you can say it's nonpartisan all you want, but it's really not, you know, and their political views and personal beliefs play into how they, you know, how they act and vote at City Hall. So we can say all day long nonpartisan, but, you know, we're counting the mayoral candidates and we're talking about everyone and we're saying left and right, you know, as we're talking about them. So I think having elected a new Republican president has just completely shifted that the dynamics and the trend that we've discussed is locally. If you have a conservative leader at the national level, then locally we would tend to go a little bit more left or Democrat in the next race for mayor. So we'll see if that trend holds true here. But what do you think, Rob?
This has always been an element of local elections, even though they've been nonpartisan. What I'm disappointed in is that national political issues have ingrained themselves so deeply into very localized kinds of decisions, and specifically immigration. That's something that we've been challenged with and something that we know is a national problem that should be addressed by the federal government. The state government has gotten into it, but it now infuses a lot of very simple discussions down at City Hall. And it creates fights where it shouldn't necessarily create fights, especially since you have folks on both sides of the issue, abortion and immigration being the two that have generated the most kind of controversy and conversation. It creates fissures among council members that shouldn't otherwise exist. And some of them grandstanding, and they're friends of mine, and some of them are grandstanding on each of these issues on both sides of each of these issues. And by creating fissures, they're not doing what they should be doing, which is filling potholes and fixing cracked sidewalks.
That's a critical issue, and you hit on the two biggest ones, immigration and abortion. We saw the council wade through the issue on providing a funding source that would reimburse people for travel expenses to leave the state to get an abortion. This is an issue that is likely, and I believe it's already being challenged in lawsuits.
Yeah, and there's a lot of discussion locally in a lot of our business groups and organizations we're part of about how has the relationship with the governor and our current mayor really affected San Antonio. And we don't really know. I mean, it's hard to really measure it, but I think that it has. So I think speaking to the mayor's race too, electing someone for our next mayor that can really try to work on those relationships with the governor and lieutenant governor, I think would help San Antonio.
The one that surprised me was Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. He praised Mayor Nuremberg at the annual Alamo Texas Independence Day fundraising event. And, you know, when I asked him, when I mentioned to him as he stepped down off the stage, you know, that was kind of you to say those words about Mayor Nuremberg. He goes, look, he and I may not agree on anything, but on the Alamo, we agree. So we set our differences aside, and we work together.
And I think that's a really good point, is that even though we're City of San Antonio and state are fighting, or at least certain folks in the city are fighting with the state, the things like the Alamo that are bigger than San Antonio, the state is not going to walk away from their responsibilities. Lieutenant Governor has done an excellent job, amazing job, really, of his focus on the Alamo and making sure it gets the support that it needs. working with local officials like the mayor and like former councilman Villagran.
I want to go to sort of a hits and misses section of this episode. So I want to talk about things that you think went well during the year in 2024 and things that did not go so well. So I will start with one and then I will let you guys chime in. So one of the hits, I think, was Councilwoman Marina Alderete Gavito's focus and leadership on the dangerous dog issue. I think this is not necessarily a sexy topic, but it's an important topic. It's an important issue, and it affects the lives of San Antonio residents. She sat down with State Senator Jose Menendez, discovered that there was a way to get things done. So I want to give him some of that credit as well. And I think the two of them working together allowed her to do what she needed to do to get the issue through the council to implement the new fines and the new ramifications if you let your dogs run loose.
I think the most important component of that ordinance being passed was that now ACS, Animal Control Services, has the ability to spay or neuter any stray animal they pick up off the street. So they bring them to ACS, they can spay or neuter them, they can charge the owner for that service if the owner comes back and picks them up, or if they don't have the capability to spay or neuter on site, then they will, you know, demand that they do it within 30 days. But because of that, adding that component to it, they're expecting to spay or neuter 600 to 700 more stray animals per year, which is great.
I think this is where Senator Menendez came in because
They thought they weren't allowed to do that legally.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And there was a little loophole in there where they figured out they were able to do that.
And I think they're going to take this to the state level. Senator Menendez's plan is to take it and get some legislation passed that could be statewide along the same lines.
For other municipalities mm-hmm. to be able to tackle. Right. All right. So, Rob, any thoughts on that one before we
go? No. I think that's great. My in-laws live in District 7. Stray dogs have been a problem for years and years and years. I also want to mention Mike Shannon, who is the Development Services Director, got moved over to Animal Control Services briefly. And even during his brief time over there, made significant strides in improving things.
He's a total pro.
He is. He's a pinch hitter.
We wish he would stay, but there's someone great coming from Oklahoma, so we're excited.
I've got a hit, and I would say we have, in my opinion, the best freshman class of new council members we've seen in a long time with Mark and Sook and Marina. They all hit the ground running. They have continued to, I think, take into account economic development and business concerns in their policy making. Now, not every council person, not every elected official can be right 100% of the time. And they've each had stumbles, I think, along the way. But in general, they've all done a great job. And so in terms of three new people coming on as a freshman class, they've all done a great job. So to me, that's a hit.
I'm going to totally agree with you on this one because I think I was surprised at not only their eagerness, but their dedication to following through what they said they wanted to do, and they're not being limited by the fact they were freshmen. They were not going to be intimidated by anybody. They charged forward and said, we're going to tackle these tough issues. We're going to work together. I think the three of them have a very close working relationship, and then, of course, the other interesting relationship that people like to talk about is the one between Mark White and Jalen McKee Rodriguez. I think they may not agree politically, but they have a very cordial relationship. And that's what you expect from your members on the council, to get along, to be able to get things done.
I think Jalen actually gets along with most of the people on city council, despite what some people think.
And that's an important part. All right, Aaron, hit or miss?
So this could be considered a hit or a miss. This would be the zoning case in District 2 that was it was a annexation agreement, a zoning agreement, or voluntary annexation. It was a whole bunch of different land use components. And Kim Brown was representing the developer. And when they got to council, the day it was coming, they were expecting to the councilman to continue the case. And instead, he let the meeting start. And then he made a motion to zone it another zoning that they weren't requesting. So it was actually down zoning it, which would not permit the use that the developer or the property owner wanted. And he did this in a manner that completely blindsided Ken and his team. They were not able to pull the item. They did not sign up to speak on the item. So they're just sitting there. There's nothing you can do once the meeting has started. And so you could kind of see it all, everyone kind of scrambling. And Councilman White ended up calling Ken up to the microphone, and he explained it. And Ken, to his credit, was flabbergasted but very polite and said, I've never seen anything like this happen. This went on for an hour at City Council, and everyone discussing it. And the, Jalen's colleagues likewise did not know he was going to do this.
They were taken by surprise.
Correct. So they were all kind of figuring out what to do. Someone made a motion to delay. It got denied. There was a couple other motions. Then Sook made a motion to delay it again, I think, or continue it for 2 weeks. And then finally, I believe the zoning did get passed the way they wanted it, and the annexation. So they got what they wanted, but it created, you know, quite a stir.
And this action ended up spurring a City Council ethics investigation.
Correct. An ethics investigation that I believe is still ongoing. So that would definitely be the miss part of it for Jalen.
So where's the hit part of it?
I mean, well, the hit part would be for the property owner that it got resolved. And, you know, I do believe there were significant concessions made between the property owner and the neighborhood that Rob knows well in his world, that you work with the neighborhood to make them feel good about what you're putting there on the property. So maybe a hit for them.
A couple of points to make on this. One, about 6.5 years ago, the legislature passed Senate Bill 6, which made annexations voluntary. Cities can't annex anymore unless the property owner agrees to annexation. So when a property owner voluntarily submits themselves for annexation, there's this element of trust that is required. You say, I'd like to come into the city, and hopefully you'll allow me to do what I'd like to do, right? You'll allow me to continue this project or start this project. And having on behalf of clients negotiated a lot of non-annexation, voluntary annexation agreements, there is still this process where it's a collaborative effort. And so what happened there disrupts that level of trust, right? It throws a wrench into that. So someone else deciding to make an investment and come into San Antonio city limits might be afraid to do that because of what happened. Now, ultimately, this situation worked itself out. But Doggett's a big company. They've made a huge investment. And the question is, does this have a chilling effect on others who have property in the extraterritorial jurisdiction who are now afraid to voluntarily annex into the city because they may have this same kind of problem come up? Well, we'll bring you in, but we're not going to zone you correctly. And so I think as a community, we should be sending positive messages to property owners, to businesses, that you do want to be inside city limits, that you want to contribute to our tax base and get city services. And so that's my bigger concern. So to me, this is a big hit. Even though ultimately it worked itself out and Doggett got what they needed, I think the messaging from this is bad all around.
And I think that was a major reason why Elon Musk said when he decided to build a Tesla plant in the Austin area, it's not within the city limits of Austin. He wanted to avoid this sort of thing. All right. Next topic is Project Marvel. I think this was a big announcement. Right now, it's an idea and a plan, and they're trying to put pieces of the puzzle together. They're trying to figure out how to fund it. But let's talk about Project Marvel. How big of an issue was it coming in 2024? Rob?
First of all, I think between Project Marvel and the baseball stadium, right, which are coming forward at the same time, both of which require city participation, other entities. Project Marvel, of course, we're looking at the demolition at the Institute of Texan Cultures, which is a long time coming, a building that was built for one purpose back to the 1968 World's Fair for Hemisphere. It's great to see that revitalization. I think what they've done with Hemisphere Park to this point has been pretty good. They have taken old properties or revitalized it, Yanagana Gardens with the children's play area. So there's been a lot of investment there, but this would be completely transformative. And so I think it's a good thing for our city. I think the baseball stadium is a good thing for the city. Ultimately, being able to articulate how it's being paid for, how much it's going to cost, and where the different buckets of money are going to come from to the average citizen is critically important. We just don't have those answers. But the concept of it will take this city to the next level. It's a huge, huge investment. And I think voters will probably be skeptical until they've learned more. Right now, all we've seen are some really great renderings on pieces of paper. And until we see more, we can't judge where the electorate's going to be.
What happens to Project Marvel when there's disagreements between the city and county? And the county judge, Peter Sakai, made the comment that he had not been briefed yet when he was approached. the day of Lori Houston's presentation to the council. What does that do to city-county relationships?
Well, I think the city and county relationships are still not great to begin with before Project Marvel and baseball. And seeing these projects kind of play out in the public eye has just brought those issues kind of further to light. So I think the city definitely spearheaded, you know, the planning of Project Marvel and baseball because the Spurs went to the city. So that might have rubbed the county a little bit the wrong way that they weren't brought in until later in the process. But I think everyone needs to just work together on this. We could have two amazing developments in downtown at the same time and really revitalize what we need at the same time via doing their expansion with ART to bring everyone to be able to come to both of these new venues downtown. So I think they need to kind of mend fences, get over it. Again, we're going to have a new mayor in 5 months, so maybe that will help with the judge. I don't know. You know, at Commissioner's Court, we still have three relatively new people in office that are still, you know, learning the ropes. I will say, if anyone can pull this project off, both these projects off, it's Lori Houston, for sure. But I do, my main caveat is that I don't want this to take away money from other, you know, institutions and entities within San Antonio that are waiting on 2027 bond money, TERS money, you know, all of our cultural institutions and parks and people that they line up for years waiting for the money. And we don't want that, these two big, amazing projects to capitalize those funds. And I don't think that they will. I think they're going to have to figure out a way to make it all work. But if we could do it, it would be great. I also grew up going to the Spurs games at the original Hemisphere Arena with season tickets with my dad. And it was the most fun experience. And downtown was awesome and alive. And you'd go to Landry's and have oysters and walk over to the game. You could take a bus from Josephine Street down, you know.
Being able to walk
and activate, again, downtown and having that many people down there with the convention center and the arena, Alamo Dome, I think it'd be amazing.
And I think post-pandemic, our downtown needs something like that.
And also, they have a very accelerated timeline on both of these. So we're not talking about 10 years. We're talking about less than 5 years if they can get the financial piece figured out.
Is this something you think ends up on the May ballot, or is it going to take a little bit longer to get it done?
I think it's going to be really tough to get it on the May ballot. I think there's a really tight deadline in the new year. I think it's, what, 4 or 6 weeks that they'd have to vote on it.
And now the Alamo Community College District is looking at $1 billion bond that they're wanting that would be on the May ballot.
I mean, it's not unheard of that they couldn't get it on the May ballot, but I think it's going to be tight. What do you think?
I think there's going to be a real push to put it on the May ballot. I think, you know, for, you know, you've got the mayor who's termed out and you've got a councilman who's termed out and you've got three council members who are running for mayor. So they all want to be able to talk about this, right, as part of the election, whether they're in favor or they're against it, or they can point to this as a success. I think they're going to want to try and get it done this term. The logistics of it, though, I think it's going to be really challenging to get it on there because goes back to my earlier point, is figuring out the buckets of money, where the dollars are coming from and where they're going, and figure all that out before May in a way that you can articulate to folks who are going out and voting and turn it into a soundbite for a campaign, something that fits on a sign, that fits into a quick little video. But I think there will be a push to get it on the May ballot.
I do know, too, another layer is that the county is very concerned of what happens to the Frost Bank Center if this plan comes to fruition. So not only the lease with the Spurs games, but you know, economic development around there and the Freeman Coliseum and that neighborhood, you know, all the plans they had talked about never materialized. So what could the county do or different and the city together to ensure that, you know, they can still use those facilities? And
I know the judge, Judge Sakai, has made it very clear that is
one of his priorities,
very high priority for him. And there's still a lot to be done. But if it can happen and you combine this with the new, not only all the components of Project Marvel, because the old federal courthouse would become a 5,000-seat arena. And then, you know, I'm on the board of the Hemisphere Conservancy. And so you look at all the investments that are going in to the Hemisphere area, and there's a lot happening there. So this has the potential. And the land bridge, I think, going over I-37 to connect the east side is something that would be a little futuristic, but I think would be a nice touch in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did it very successfully in Dallas, and I think also Houston. So, we know it can be done. It's just how do we pay for it?
With Project Marvel, with baseball, with some of these other thoughts, it's really one of the few times that San Antonio has taken a big, bold idea like this. We do this obviously with Hemisphere in 68. We've done it a few other times, did with the Alamo Dome. But it's rare that we take on these big projects. But I think it's good. I think the timing is right with a new mayor, with Judge Sakai being relatively new in office, only 2 years in. Think about that. New council members. This is the time to look forward. And I think this is the time to really build the blocks for San Antonio's future.
You've been listening to Rob Killen and Aaron Bly, two veteran observers of City Hall politics, taking a look back at 2024. From the entire team at Beyond the Bite, we wish all of you a very happy new year. Beyond the Bite is a production of Aldrete Strategic Partners, a public affairs and communications consulting firm based in San Antonio, Texas. It is edited by Nick Chamberlain of Every Word Media and sponsored by Llano Realty Partners. Our best wishes for a happy, safe, and prosperous 2025. As always, we thank you for listening.